this park is literally trying to kill you. That's why I loved it so much, though. This is the Exploring the National Parks podcast with Dirt in My Shoes. My name is Ash, and I'm a former park ranger and the founder of Dirt in My Shoes. I think that the parks are best seen from the trail, and I'm here to make national park trip planning easy.
And I'm John. I carry the kids on the trails, I tell stories, and notice all the things that Ash doesn't care about much, like flowers.
Join us as we show you around America's spectacular national parks.
We're sharing our favorite places, fun facts, adventures, and misadventures.
And we'll even throw in a little trip planning.
Let's start exploring.
Well, we have some great news. I think it's great news. Did you know that you can now get the podcast on YouTube?
Yeah.
And YouTube Music. That's mainly why we did it, because they want us to be on YouTube Music. So it's not the podcast on YouTube doesn't have our faces. It's not like a
it's not a video podcast, but it does have video of the beautiful national parks.
It does. But so you can get all of our episodes on YouTube now, which was just a massive project, by the way. I'm so glad that's done.
Going forward, it'll be much easier instead of moving an entire database of podcast episodes over in one fell swoop.
Yeah. So anyway, we just wanted to let you guys know if you prefer to get, I know John listens to his podcast on YouTube Music.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can find us there. So go check it out. I'm really excited to talk about Glacier Bay today.
Yes. Me too. And I'm even wearing my Glacier Bay sweatshirt.
I'm a little nervous because although I worked as a park ranger at Glacier Bay, John always teases me that I was probably like the worst park ranger ever because I don't know things about things.
Mm-hmm. There was a big book of birds that you could see. I think it was at the visitor center, and people would come in and ask Ash, so what bird was this? I don't know. Check the book.
No idea. My best friend, when I worked up there, she also worked at the visitor information station with me, but she would go tide pooling like on all of her time off and stuff. And she made this huge like database, really cool book that you could take with you to the tide pools. And she had photographs of all the different little creatures and stuff.
Nice.
She'd come back and she'd be like, I found 5 new creatures today and here's what they are and stuff like that. And I was like, see, she's a good park ranger. I'm just like, where are the sea stars? That's the only thing I know that I can see is a sea star. So I'm a little bit nervous about this episode just because I feel like I probably don't know anything about what you're going to be talking about today.
You never know. I think you might. We'll see. This one, you never know. We'll see. I have a lot of crazy stuff. And we're actually going to be breaking tradition a little bit.
Oh, really?
Yes. There.
No Lord of the Rings jokes in this episode.
Those just come to me. And so.
So that's not what you're referring to.
Definitely not referring to that. No, we're going to be breaking tradition a little bit in that we are actually going to start with the human history.
Okay.
Because usually that's fun fact number 5. But as I was like doing some research and checking out Glacier Bay, I was like, this is the perfect way to start because it just sets the bar so high and helps people realize why this place is so cool. And I think that's what we're going to do today.
I'm really excited. So just again, another disclaimer, this is Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska.
Yes.
Not Glacier National Park in Montana.
Right.
People get these ones confused. They're two different parks. But we are headed to Alaska today for Glacier Bay National Park. So don't confuse them. Don't mix them up. We're not talking about the park in Montana that everybody loves. We're talking about Glacier Bay, which a lot of people don't even know exists.
Yes. Very different. Still super cool. So let's go ahead and get started. Now, Ash, you know that I love explorers. And if you've listened to this podcast, you should know I think explorers are fascinating. And just the adrenaline and the sense of awe that you get from the actual act of discovery is just so cool. From Marco Polo to Christopher Columbus and all the way to present day, explorers have inspired us with their great stories of adventure and discovery. Now, what I find really interesting, though, is that a lot of the things that we know these explorers for now, they kind of came as like a byproduct or an accident on their true mission, right? So like Christopher Columbus, he wasn't actually trying to find the New World. He was trying to find a trade route to India, right? A safer, faster trade route to India. Marco Polo, he explored a lot of the areas along the Silk Road. So a lot of times they just stumble upon cool things on their way towards their real goal, right? Now, when Christopher Columbus arrived on the other side of the New World, what we now call Glacier Bay was home to a thriving community of native people. Do you know the name of the tribe?
The Tlingit.
The Tlingit people, yes. And I always, my brain does not, it starts with
it's a T.
T.
Yeah.
So even though you make like a K sound, it always tricks my brain. So I had to have you say it first to make sure that I pronounced it properly. Yeah. The Tlingit people, they were living here and there was no bay. It was just a huge mountain valley. And they would set up summer fishing camps along a river, but they lived in this giant valley and they would catch salmon in incredible numbers far off in the distance. There were some mountains with beautiful but harmless glaciers resting around them. And honestly, that sounds awesome. It probably was a tougher life than I'm imagining.
There's so much salmon. If I was a Native American, I would want to live where there was salmon.
Yeah, that sounds pretty ideal to me too.
Yeah, I mean, instead of like having to eat sagebrush or roots or whatever.
If you lived in Joshua Tree and you had to like forage through the cactuses and stuff, be way different than putting out your nets into this beautiful river and catching a bunch of salmon.
Well, and when I lived up there, we would go and you can pick berries. There's just wild strawberries.
Oh.
And wild blueberries everywhere
in this
area. And so, yeah, and there were people who would come and they would bring us stuff that they would forage for.
Mm-hmm.
Fern heads that you put in salad and stuff. Like, it's just like everybody who still kind of lives up there still lives off the land in some way.
Yes.
Which is cool.
The gathering part of the hunting and gathering.
Yeah, so much fish. We would have massive fish fries because everybody's freezers are just full of fish.
Yes.
That fish is $30 a pound at home.
In the lower 48.
And up there, they're just trying to get rid of it.
Yeah.
So, that's where I'd want to live.
Yes. So that is like the mountain paradise that existed here when Christopher Columbus arrived in the New World on the far side of North America. For the next few hundred years, the goals changed a little bit. They were no longer looking for that quick trade route to India via the Atlantic through the Pacific. They were now looking for a quick route.
They, as in explorers that came after.
From like the late 1500s to the early 1800s.
Okay.
They were now like looking, okay, we've got to find a quick way that we can get from the Atlantic to the Pacific instead of having to sail all the way down underneath South America and then popping back up. It just takes so long. And so the idea of this mythical Northwest Passage that we now know doesn't even exist. The goal was to be able to sail from Hudson Bay to like Washington or Oregon or British Columbia and kind of go out that side. That's what they were looking for. And so you had all these explorers that answered the call to find this passage. You had people like Juan de Fuca from Spain. You had this guy from France, Jean-François de Galep, Comte de la Prusse. He was from France. And then you had two guys from England. You had Captain James Cook and George Vancouver. They all sailed around South America. They all came up here towards where the Tlingit people were living, and they wanted to find this Northwest Passage. Well, since we know that that doesn't exist, what a lot of these men are now known for are things they discovered along the way. So Captain Vancouver, for example, he's obviously the namesake for several cities in the Pacific Northwest and a giant island alongside British Columbia. Now, when Captain Vancouver, when he visited this area of Alaska where the Tlingit people lived in 1794.
So he did go that far up.
He did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, because Glacier Bay is in southeast Alaska, so it's actually not that far into Alaska. It's down in the islands.
Right.
Really, that border Canada right there as you're going up the coast.
Right.
So that's an important distinction, too, is we're not up in the main part of Alaska. We're in the part that dips down towards Washington.
Right, exactly. Some of the Spanish explorers made it up to the Kenai Peninsula.
Okay.
And so they made it pretty far north. So as they were searching for this Northwest Passage, they were mapping everything and claiming it for their own countries, mm-hmm. a lot of them along the way. In 1794, Captain Vancouver, he came into this area where the Tlingit people lived. Now, all the way from 1492, even into the 1600s, we know that the Tlingit people lived in this gorgeous mountain paradise. And so that's what we should expect Captain Vancouver to find. But what he actually found, instead of finding a wide open paradise, he encountered an icy strait carved 1,400 feet deep and filled with a glacier over 20 miles wide, 4,000 feet thick, and more than 100 miles long.
Yes! Yes!
And so, within a few hundred years, in what I can only describe as an icy Armageddon, a giant glacier formed and pushed an entire civilization out of its ancestral home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little awkward that you were just cheering for that.
For that glacier, I know. But I love glaciers getting bigger.
I know, that's true.
that's what I'm cheering for.
We gotta clarify what we're cheering for.
I'm not cheering for the people being displaced. It's just crazy. The glacier was coming out of the mountains that quickly that they were pushed out. But just that there was enough of a glacier there.
I know. It's incredible. Glaciers are just amazing. So I can absolutely understand cheering for the existence of these amazing brutes, especially this one, 20 miles wide and 4,000 feet deep. But this is where it gets even more interesting. 5 years after Captain Vancouver surveyed the area, a Russian, which we never actually get to say that country.
Right.
Russians.
Well, it makes sense. They're just on the other side of the ocean.
Exactly. So, a Russian by the name of Baranov landed about 100 miles south and he settled Sitka. And he decided that was going to be the new capital of Russian America. And so he claimed the entire area. And so for the next 80 years, we honestly don't have any idea what's going on in the area. But in 1867, America bought Alaska from the Russians for about $7 million.
Best purchase ever.
People were really hating on him for that.
Yeah,
I'm sure. When the president bought that, that's like, what a terrible investment. A few years after that purchase, a fellow by the name of John Muir visited the area. And he was intrigued by glaciers and he was hoping to study the ones that were in the area here. Obviously, by the maps, there's a huge one.
Well, and a lot of people don't know that John Muir made it up to Glacier Bay.
Yeah.
Which is so cool. He was actually a really big part of Glacier Bay, but yeah,
it's really cool.
You think of Yosemite and everything. He did so much down lower.
Yeah, well, his theory, which was somewhat contradictory to a lot of other geologists at the time, he thought that Yosemite Valley was carved out by glaciers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other people didn't agree with him. So that's part of why he came up here. He wanted to study the glaciers so that he could prove his theories. He hired a few Tlingit guides and they got in canoes and they came to this area where Captain Vancouver had mapped a giant glacier. And so as John Muir and these Tlingit guides are canoeing into this area, if he relied on Vancouver's maps, he would have expected to see that 20-mile-wide, 4,000-foot-thick glacier sitting right there for him to study. Instead, he found the mouth of an open bay with giant mountains on each side, and life abundant all around him. And if he wanted to find that glacier that Vancouver described, he would need to paddle 40 more miles up the bay.
That's what's crazy. Like, it just it came and then it went.
Yes, exactly.
I don't even get it.
Yeah.
But it came fast enough that the native peoples had to flee this advancing glacier that's coming into where they're living.
Right.
So they go across the icy strait over to what is now called Huna. It's the Huna Tlingit that live over in there. They're the original ones that used to live where Glacier Bay is now.
Right.
But they got pushed across the strait.
Yeah.
And then it's just gone.
Yeah, exactly. And then even by 1916, you'd have to go 65 miles from the mouth of Glacier Bay to find that glacier. And so it's just
crazy.
So this is fun fact number one. Fun fact number one is that these are the fastest glaciers in the world.
For real.
As far as I can tell, there is no other place on Earth that can match the speed at which the glaciers here advanced and then retreated.
It is so cool.
It's crazy. Yeah. There's actually a Guinness World Record for this.
Oh, really?
The Guinness World Record for the fastest glacier retreat is 574 feet in 1 year. Okay, and that was somewhere in the Swiss Alps. If we just do basic math, these glaciers retreated 40 miles over 80 years from Vancouver to John Muir. That's only 40 miles over 80 years. That's an average of 2,640 feet per year, which is almost five times faster than the world record.
Why did they not take that glacier into account?
Probably because they have to
only start from a certain year or something.
I think that they have to like have specific records or someone there to have a starting point and an ending point and things like that. Five times faster. And that doesn't even take into account that as these glaciers get smaller and closer to their place of origin, that they start to slow down. So I bet you we could easily have seen retreat speeds of up to a mile a year. And who knows how fast these glaciers advanced, how fast they came at those Tlingit villages. Retreating, advancing is scarier.
And we're not talking about thousands of years ago either. I mean, we're in the hundreds of years.
Yeah, all of this happened over, there's evidence of the Tlingit people living in their villages in this mountain valley by Bartlett Cove or something like that into the 1600s.
Yeah.
And so all of this happened over such a short period of time. It is mind-boggling, honestly, to put yourself in the shoes or the moccasins of one of those Tlingit Native Americans. That would be so scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Keep that idea of scary these glaciers are going in your mind for a second, because speaking of scary, that's going to jump right into fun fact number two. Fun fact number two is that Glacier Bay National Park is the location of the largest recorded
tidal wave
in history.
Yes. And I have been there. Yeah, it's a remote area of the park, but yeah. I actually got to go. No kidding.
Okay. I can't ask you one of my random questions now and hope to stump you, because if you already know where it was, do you know how tall that wave was?
I did when I worked there, but no, I can't. All I know is that the way that it's set up, it was like a bowl. And so the wave sloshed both sides.
Yeah. Okay. So it's crazy. For you at home listening, to give you a frame of reference, keep in mind that in October of 2020, a surfer by the name of Sebastian Stutner made surfing history by surfing a wave 86 feet tall. That's a huge wave. And if you watch the video, it's absolutely insane. The wave here at Glacier Bay was 1,700 feet tall.
Oh my gosh. I was like, maybe like 200?
No, it's huge.
Okay. 1,700?
Yes. So let's talk about this. It all happened in a part of Glacier Bay that's a little bit more remote called Lituya Bay.
Yeah, nobody goes out there.
Nobody goes
really
out there.
It's not the main channel of Glacier Bay where you go in the cruise ships and stuff. It's you keep going along the icy strait up further into the islands and stuff. Anyway, you'll pass it, but yeah.
It's on the outside to the open ocean. It's open to the open ocean. So it's on the far west side of Glacier Bay. And Glacier Bay is peppered with all of these little inlets or bays or fjords, because the glaciers coming out of the mountains, when they advance, they carve a mountain. When they retreat, they just leave these lakes or places for the ocean to take over. That's what Lituya Bay is. And so it's a standalone bay on the outside. Well, as these glaciers, these giant glaciers advanced, they have an effect on the ground and on the land that they're on top of. They are literally so heavy that they compact the ground and push it down. They compress it down almost like you're squishing a sponge. When those glaciers retreat, the weight is no longer on the ground anymore, and so the ground starts to decompress and it starts to expand back. And it's called isostatic rebound.
Yeah. And it's still doing that. That's what's crazy.
Yes.
That area is still coming back up out of its compression.
Yes. It's a very slow rebound, So it's still happening here, and it's averaging about an inch a year.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been as fast as 2 inches a year. So how does this relate to a giant wave? Well, as the land expands, it causes things in the ground, in the earth, to shift and move and break and become unstable. And normally we call that earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have this entire landscape that is expanding and growing and shaking. And as it does that, it causes epic landslides. In 1958, not that long ago, an earthquake about an 8.0 on the Richter scale rocked this area in Lituya Bay. And as this earthquake happened, it shook the earth on this mountainside, and it caused this giant landslide that just crashed into Lituya Bay. And this giant landslide, as it splashed into the ocean, it created a giant wave that just tsunamied across the bay. And the reason we know it's 1,700 feet tall is because that's the water line on the mountain on the other side of the bay.
It's so crazy.
And so it's just, if you can just imagine this in your mind, if you will, holy cow, what a crazy bathtub type sloshing activity.
Yeah, and it did. It sloshed back and forth. So that initial wave would have been really high.
Yeah.
But then it would just slosh back to the other side,
mm-hmm.
probably almost equally as high, a little bit not as high, but just kept sloshing.
Oh, man.
It would have been terrifying. What I can't remember from when I worked there was, did anybody see it, or was anybody like in there? Because sometimes people lived in these little areas. Mm-hmm.
There were some fishing vessels in there, and unfortunately, they didn't make it.
There'd be no way
to
survive that.
Oh, man. Our like tsunami warning systems, like you lived in Hawaii and you had to worry about tsunami warnings and stuff like that. And a lot of those waves are only 14 feet high or less.
They can do so much damage. It only takes a little bit of water.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy.
A little bit of water where it's not, you know, where you don't want it.
Exactly.
So I can't just even imagine this. Yeah.
But there are places within Glacier Bay where, because this happened, they decided we got to keep an eye on stuff.
Yeah.
And so they are tracking unstable places all throughout Glacier Bay. And not to scare anybody, but there's a spot inside the main bay where they're tracking one, and it's on a side fjord or an inlet. It's called Tidal Inlet.
Uh-huh.
And if this landslide was to go, it would slosh around its own bay. Then the waves would reach into the main bay and possibly create waves of over 250 feet. And most cruise ships are less than 250 feet tall. it's a wild landscape.
There's boats up by Tidal Inlet all the time. That's not an area that doesn't see people.
Right.
And we talked about this in the other episode too. Like, this park is literally trying to kill you. That's why I loved it so much, though, because you just look around yourself and you're like, I am just a speck. I am a tiny little speck. And there's so much that can happen here that I have no control over.
Right.
It's so humbling.
Yeah.
And to stand somewhere like that is an experience that everybody should have at least once in your life, to be somewhere where we have no control over what happens and you can just see it in front of you.
Right.
Oftentimes you don't have control
right
in your everyday life too, but to be somewhere like Glacier Bay where you're just like, see the raw power of nature, and it's not reined in at all.
No.
You're just living amongst it, and maybe you shouldn't.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Right. Exactly.
Oh, it's everybody should experience that once in their life.
Yeah, exactly. And we just keep stressing, this is such a wild place, but not only wild, like I feel like the right word is volatile.
Mm-hmm.
Like it could change at any moment and there's nothing you can do about it. And so there's so many crazy things about the story that we started with. The fact that these glaciers, they advanced and retreated so fast within people's lifetimes, they were visibly forcing people out. And the 80 years of darkness basically is so crazy to me that the Russians took over and we have no idea. I've been watching a lot of X-Files lately. And so if you've ever watched the X-Files movie, I think the original one, they end up going to Antarctica. And what happens is they discover an alien ship and it takes off out of Antarctica and just leaves this giant hole where the alien ship was. Maybe that's that first 40 miles was. It was just an alien ship. Anyways, that's crazy. And then this entire bay being carved out because it wasn't here before.
Yeah.
This whole bay, 1,400 feet deep, is now here and it's been carved out by that glacier. Anyways, this place is crazy. But you know who noticed how crazy this place is? Scientists.
Mm-hmm.
It's really crazy to talk about it and be like, wow, this place is nuts. But scientists are just crazy over this place.
They're like chomping at the bit. Get me up there.
Yeah. And you experienced some of this. You went out with researchers.
Coolest part of the job.
Yeah.
Hands down, being able to go out in the little research boats.
Oh my gosh. Do you know how much research is being done here? They have a page where you just keep scrolling and just listing all the different studies that they're currently working on right now. But scientists from so many different fields are up here asking questions and testing theories. I mean, where else can you literally watch ice age events playing out in real time?
Mm-hmm.
Where else can you observe, measure, and record both directions of climate change, the warming and the cooling? You can ask questions like, how quickly can glaciers grow and expand? In what conditions can that happen? And how will that affect people, plants, animals, and broader weather patterns, and even like ocean currents and jet streams? And then the opposite, how fast can they retreat? You learn so much. And so Glacier Bay became synonymous with science. And it still is. It's a living biology lab, a living geology lab, a living whatever-ology you want to study. It is here at Glacier Bay. It all started in 1916 with the scientists, a botanist named William Cooper. He arrived in Glacier Bay. He wanted to study the process of plant succession. Basically, he wanted to see how quickly you could go from a rock to a rainforest, because everything is so fresh here. When the glaciers advanced and then retreated, they literally scraped everything out.
Mm-hmm.
All life is gone. And so you're basically just left with a rock. He saw this place and he was like, oh my gosh, there's so many things I can study here. We have to protect it. And so in 1925, after a lot of his advocacy for it, Glacier Bay became a national monument. And then later in 1980, it was made a national park.
Pretty much every other national park.
Right,
in Alaska. Yeah.
The 80s were big for Alaska.
The 80s were big for Alaska, yeah.
But the explicit language and purpose of Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve is to protect the dynamic tidewater glacial landscape and the associated natural succession processes for science and accessible discovery in a wilderness setting. So this is fun fact number three. Fun fact number three is that both times the U.S. government formalized the preservation and protection of this place, it did it specifically for scientific discovery. It literally placed a flag on Glacier Bay National Park and claimed this land for science. This place had been explored by Spain, England, France. It had been claimed by Russia and the U.S. But now, and perhaps forevermore, Glacier Bay is claimed and protected and set aside for science.
Yes.
And I think that is so cool.
Go science.
I know. I just feel like such a nerd geeking out on this, but it's such a cool place.
Well, now I'm trying to think through all the research that they're, I mean, I'm sure there's a ton that I didn't even know they were doing. The most visible, obviously, the glaciers.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll have like small planes that fly up and map stuff.
Right.
And so I knew they did that. The wildlife is huge.
Yep.
There's bear scientists. There's whale scientists. There's multiple whale scientists for humpbacks and orcas.
Right.
I know they're doing a lot there too.
Yeah, exactly. Tons of stuff with marine biology.
Yeah.
Tons of stuff with glaciology. Tons of stuff in almost every field you can find scientific discovery happening at Glacier Bay.
Yeah. The harbor seals have their own scientists.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, it's just, I never thought about it, though.
It's a living laboratory to ask questions and test theories and to eventually find answers.
Well, and I like that, too, because a lot of times for the national parks, like we're going to this national park for us, like for us to have an adventure.
Right.
For us to have things to do.
Yeah.
And Glacier Bay is not like that either.
Right.
It's not like you go to Glacier Bay because you're like, we got to knock this off our bucket list and we got to go see this and we got to do this and we got to hike this trail. And it's a very different experience in a national park than other national parks too.
Right.
And I think now that I'm making the connection, I'm like, it probably does have to do with the fact that it's like a living laboratory and you don't go to Glacier Bay just for fun.
Right.
Nobody goes to Glacier Bay just for fun.
I know. It's such an interesting park. Yeah. The culture of the park, especially the people that actually spend more than a few days there, is so scientifically oriented. You can come in, 90-something percent of the people come in through cruise ship. A very small group of people actually set foot in Glacier Bay and kayak around and do some exploring and things like that. So much that actually goes on here is science. And honestly, there's some things that I think is so cool. Like in a world that is so concerned with climate change, Glacier Bay, in a lot of ways, is the perfect laboratory. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's a beacon of hope, honestly, because at least to me, when I look at some of the research and the answers gained from the science here, it gives me hope. And this is why. So William Cooper, he wanted to know how quickly life can return after glaciers come through and remove all life. How quickly you can go from rock to rainforest. This is fun fact number four, and it blew me away. Fun fact number four is that in Glacier Bay, after the glaciers scraped everything away and left you bare rock, it took less than 75 years for the landscape to return to a rainforest.
No way.
Yeah. He set up some scientific plots in 1916 when he got there, and there's pictures of it, of that same plot going from just like this rocky landscape to a rainforest.
It is a rainforest.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And the trees are huge and there's moss on everything. And
oh man.
So it's not like a baby rainforest either.
No, it's amazing. The whole process, that this is what he called plant succession. You have a rock and then lichen spores attach to that rock. And the rhizosomes, it's like the roots of the lichen, they basically secrete acid into the rock. And that breaks up the rocks a little bit to start. It's the beginning of soil.
Yeah.
Right. And so then you get a few other plants that come in that put nitrogen into the soil. And then a few seeds get blown to that area and they start to put roots in. And it's just this breaking down and creating of the soil. And then eventually you get alder and then you get hemlock and in spruce trees. And that's what we have in a lot of these places where life has found a way. It came back. Mm-hmm. And so it gives me hope in terms of like climate change stuff, because I know there's places around the world that we've screwed up. There's places that we've polluted or used up all the natural resources, but given the right circumstances and maybe a little bit of help, we can bring these places back. Mm-hmm. And Glacier Bay is a perfect example of how that can happen. One more scientific discovery that kind of gives me some hope. So this comes from researcher Sandy Milner. And he wanted to find out how long it would take for salmon to recolonize a new stream following a glacier's retreat, right?
Interesting.
So obviously,
I didn't even think about all the fishing and all the, there's got to be tons of research going on with all the fisheries and all the salmon coming back. And
exactly.
Oh my gosh.
Well,
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. So you can obviously think about how that research study would be applicable to the broader scale.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Because there's so many rivers that we either dammed or have been polluted or have dried up because of drought and stuff like that. And so this research could be useful and give hope to people around the world. He wanted to figure this out. Here in Glacier Bay, pink salmon and other fish, he found that they would recolonize a stream in as little as 10 years. That's so cool for a lot of our fisheries around the world.
Well, and I even think what comes to mind is like in Olympic National Park, they just took down the dams on the Elwha River,
right,
which is a very traditional salmon route that they would take in from the ocean. And I'm just wondering, some of the research maybe that was done in Glacier Bay, like the salmon, how long till they come back?
Right.
Like that could have influenced partially a decision to take down dams
right
on the Elwha River in Olympic so that those salmon could come back.
You
know, I don't know for sure, but I'm like, that's so cool that there actually could be a connection there.
Yeah. This is meaningful science.
Yeah.
I think that's happening here.
Because they just barely did that like a couple years ago.
Right.
I think we were visiting the park at that point. Like we were there when they were taking the dams down. So anyway, so cool.
Oh, it's just so neat. This place, it's a living laboratory and there's a lot to be excited about. And yes, it's really cool for scientists, but when you visit and you have some of this information, it can really enrich your trip to realize what you're looking at can be applied to the world more broadly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really cool. But now I want to get into fun fact number five that really is for the visitors and it's not for the scientists as much. For this last fun fact of the day, fun fact number five is that Glacier Bay National Park has such a wide array of wildlife that they actually have on the website a wildlife viewing calendar that people can use to help plan their trips around.
Nice. They have it on the website?
Yeah, it's
on. Oh, really?
Yeah. You click on the website, you go to learn about the park, go to nature, and then there's under animals, there's a wildlife calendar. And they have for each season, they kind of walk you through the months to show you what animals you'll be able to see. And that's land animals and sea animals.
Okay, so seeing the tidewater glaciers at Glacier Bay National Park is like, should be top of list.
Yes.
Because it's so cool that you can actually see the glaciers still coming into the ocean up there.
Right.
But the reason that you don't ever forget your experience in this park is the wildlife.
Yeah.
Hands exactly. down. It's the coolest thing about this park.
Yes. It's so true.
And I don't know that you really like, I think a lot of people come to want to see the glaciers, which is absolutely the reason to come here. But to get to the glaciers, it's quite a trek. And along that trek, the wildlife is just unreal. Like, I don't know. For me, it was like I was so excited about the glaciers and working somewhere that was carved out by glaciers. But I did not think or take into account the effect that the wildlife in this park would have for just overall adventure and enjoyment.
Oh, yeah.
It enhances everything.
It's so true. And what's really cool, actually, along with those glaciers, when they do calve, they leave these giant icebergs in the water. And in the spring, between March and June, so early spring to June, there's this amazing time where the harbor seals give birth to their pups. And a lot of times you'll see the harbor seals on the little icebergs.
Well, that's what they use. Yeah, that's what they use for their pupping. And everything is the icebergs.
Yeah, it's cool.
And
so
the
cool.
whole area is closed because they don't want you to bug the seals.
Yes.
Which is very smart.
The baby seals time also correlates with a large amount of killer whale time.
Yes.
And so you can have a Discovery Channel experience possibly seeing those seals.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There are so many killer whales in that water.
Oh my gosh. That's a spring option. So you go up for the glaciers, but even if you go up for the glaciers, like you said, you'll be treated to so many wildlife experiences
mm-hmm.
and viewing opportunities. In the spring, the seals and the killer whales are big. In the summer, you get the humpback whales.
I could talk about the humpback whales forever.
Okay,
that was the most unreal experience of my life was living somewhere where I could hear the humpback whales from my apartment. I just opened my window and you can hear them just spouting. You mm-hmm. can just hear them. And I was like, where am I? this can't be real life.
I know. It's so crazy. And they show up in the summer in huge numbers. They show up in the summer because they're feeding, because the water here is so rich in nutrients. That's why it's not clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so the humpback whales, they migrate between tropical, really clear water and this area up here where it's really nutrient rich. Because the reason that in the tropics, the water is so clear is because it doesn't have very much nutrients. And I didn't realize this, that humpback whales actually don't eat when they're in the tropics. Because
they save it all for when they get to Alaska.
Yeah, it takes so much energy for them to digest their food that they're basically fasting for almost 6 months.
That's
and
crazy.
So when they come up to Glacier Bay, they're eating almost half a ton a day.
Uh-huh.
And it's because there's so much food here. They just go to town and they put on so much weight while they're here.
Yeah.
And so it's just so cool.
Do you know what's cool about the humpback whales too? I've never loved humpback whales as much as I did when I lived in Glacier Bay. Mm-hmm. Now they're like my favorite. But the researchers, I got to go out with the researchers and they take pictures of the flukes mm-hmm. of these whales and they identify the whales by their flukes. All the flukes are different. And so they so they have their whales named just based off the flukes.
Wow.
And when I'm talking about flukes, it's their tail, the two fins.
The tail fin.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a fingerprint.
It is. And so these researchers, they know which whale they're looking at when they're researching. And these whales have been coming back to Glacier Bay for decades. And they'll be like, oh, there's so-and-so. She made it.
Wow.
And these researchers have all of that cataloged. So they can actually track this whale has been coming to Glacier Bay for this amount of time. And they'll notice if the whale doesn't come.
Whoa.
They'll know either that whale died or they'll just keep tracking them by all their flukes.
That's nuts. It's
insane.
Do you think you could recognize me just from my backside?
Yes, probably.
That's an interesting thought. Anyways, that's crazy.
John's had multiple back surgeries, so his body's all twisted and weird. But
very recognizable.
Isn't that crazy? It is like a fingerprint, and they know the whale that they are looking at just based on, because they'll dive every certain amount of time.
Right.
And so then they can take pictures of the flukes and they know which whale they're looking at.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
I want to be familiar enough with humpback whales to recognize them by their tail fin.
Yeah.
By their fluke.
Yeah. This researcher, like her name is Janet, and I don't know if she's still there, but like she's been up there for years and years and she knows all these whales like by name.
Mm-hmm.
And she's in this tiny little dinghy. Like it's not a big boat. It's like an inflatable almost. Like it's a tiny little boat that she just uses, and she just putters around Glacier Bay and watches these whales and watches what they're doing and how they're feeding and which ones they are and have they had babies. And
wow,
it's crazy.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So if you didn't already love humpback whales, you will absolutely fall in love with them when you go to Glacier Bay. They are the coolest animals.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they jump. Oh, they're so cool. They do. They put on a show for you sometimes too, which is just incredible.
That's awesome. And so if you want to see those, which you should want to see them, that's a big summer deal.
And you don't even have to go in a kayak or anything. You can stand on the shores of Bartlett Cove, which is the park headquarters area. You can just stand by the water and watch the whales. You don't even have to go on a boat.
That's so cool.
It's crazy.
Oh my gosh. I wonder if you can tell a difference in the size of their fluke by the end of the summer versus like the beginning of the summer. Like if they've been fasting all year, they get here. And then by the end, you're like, man, they got some junk in that fluke.
I don't think so. Some junk in that fluke. Oh my gosh.
Oh man.
They're so cool.
They are so cool.
I'm obsessed.
That's summer. So you want to see them in the summertime. Now, the salmon, different types of salmon run at different times. And so if you want to come up here to go fishing or something, you got to consult the calendar. Make sure that you know which ones you're looking for. But then in October, you can see the giant moose that they have up there with their full racks. Now, this is something that I thought was super cool. In November is bald eagle season.
Which, who goes to Glacier Bay in November?
I know.
I'm just saying.
All the reason I tell you this is because they have it on the calendar.
Okay.
They have
bald
the
eagle
calendar.
Season.
So the bald eagles, right across from a little bit further east from Glacier Bay, you have another bay with a city called Haines.
Mm-hmm.
And Haines, every November, has the largest concentration of bald eagles in the world. In Glacier Bay, you'll also be able to see a whole lot of bald eagles, but it's just a really cool thing to see in the fall coming into winter. But all throughout the year, you have tons of different birds that come in here and they detail which birds you are. And so if you're a birder and you have a specific bird you want to see, check out the calendar.
Glacier Bay has puffins.
Yes, they do have puffins.
So that's pretty cool.
They're so cool. But people, you need to get here. There's so much to see. There's so much to experience. And it's breathtakingly beautiful. It's wild and untamed. It's volatile, as we covered early on in the episode. But this place just blows you away. It's so much fun.
I love Glacier Bay so much. so much. I was so blessed to be able to work up there. And I think based off this episode, what I would like to do for your task this week, if you made it to the very end, go to our Dirt in My Shoes Instagram or Facebook pages and let us know which fun fact surprised you the most.
Oh,
because yeah. I have to say, I was pretty surprised. Even though I knew, I actually did know a lot of what you talked about.
Right.
Go me. I did know a lot of it. But even there was some big surprises in there for me, even
right.
though I worked there. So head over to Instagram or Facebook, Dirt in My Shoes, and let us know which one surprised you the most or what you're most excited about.
Right. And then after you do that, we would love to get a 5-star review. So if you wouldn't mind taking the time to do that and giving the Exploring the National Parks podcast a 5-star review, we would really appreciate it.
Thank you for exploring the national parks with us today. We are so excited that you're here, and we hope that you make it to Glacier Bay sometime soon.